No, wait, guys, it's a lesson.
The lesson of thirds, said Terry.
I ever tell you guys about the two German girls I took home?
It wasn't as fun as you would think, even before the gonorrhea.
One time I took too much Special K and ended up with two fat, ugly motherfuckers. Not a good time, Sasha said and pointed at me. Don't touch that shit.
Threes, threes, the three amigos, I said.
No, sorry, the five amigos.
Jesus, Skip, will you shut up and make a pretty little line?
Ariel scrolled through her iPod.
Then we're done.
Are you high? I asked Ariel. I turned to Will and Sasha.
Wait, are you high? Is anyone high?
I made the line the way she taught me. About the length of a cigarette, evenly distributed, with sharp, tapered ends.
I'm high.
Ariel passed me a Negroni, and it tasted like cough syrup.
Medicine.
Hey, guys, I think I hate my job.
They laughed.
No, I'm serious. Isn't it kind of depressing and dirty in there lately?
What you think? Everyone, look. Alice just wake up and, oh, fuck, no Wonderland.
Maybe you should hit the pause button every now and then, Will said, and I turned away from him.
I'm putting your favorite song on, Skip.
Ariel was aggressive about music. She had made me a few CD mixes, the depths of my ignorance presented in 16 tracks. It never ended well. For her, the enjoyment of music was contingent on its obscurity. Once people knew about it, she discarded it, moved on. And yet she was always trying to educate me. Every time I told her I liked a song she had shown me, she put on a disappointed smirk and said, "You would." Which I thought had been the point.
"You don't know my favorite song," I said.
When I caught her eyes, they were like rain-washed windows I couldn't see inside. Worry fluttered through me, and I took another drink.
"No LCD," Terry said, hitting his hand on the bar for emphasis.
"I will shoot myself, Ari," said Will.
"Fuck you, fuck your mothers. If you talk shit on James Murphy, I will fucking kill you."
The song came on. Heartbeats. I clapped my hands.
"Oh, I do like this song."
"Why you squeal like a piggy?"
"Sasha, come on, it's my song."
I moved my shoulders and shut my eyes, dizzy, white cloudbursts inside my lids. I pulled Sasha off the stool. I swung my hair in front of my face like Ariel taught me. My body dilated under the water of the synthetic bass. It was an apathy dance. I heard Ariel singing, and when Will took my hand and spun me, I smiled, lip-syncing. "To call for hands of above to lean on wouldn't be good enough for me, oh." All the movement stopped, and I looked toward the door. Vivian stood, wobbling, cautious. I waved and looked at Ariel, who had a glass in her hand. It went flying by my face and into the wall next to Vivian. The sound came seconds later. I had already watched it explode and shower the floor. No snapping, nothing clean. Full disintegration. During the delay in sound, I covered my eyes.
"Where the fuck have you been?"
"You're out, Ari," Terry yelled. "God fucking damn it."
Vivian looked bored. Ariel grabbed a handful of straws and threw them before Will grabbed her by the shoulders.
I'm sorry," I heard someone call out above the music.
The song ended, and I realized it was me. Vivian walked to the bar, not looking at Ariel, and sighed as she brought up the hand broom.
"Sorry, Terry," she said. "Oh, she's sorry, Terry?"
Ariel wrestled as Will held her arms down.
"Let's go, string bean. Party's over."
Sasha grabbed her purse, and Will picked her up and went to the door. Sasha waved to someone out the window.
Oh, and look, Victor baby is here.
I know you, Ariel yelled at Vivian. Her voice shot and guttural.
I know everything about you.
Nearly 5 a.m. in the park. A frigid night that should have been blown over by sleep. Empty bottles rattled in the gutters. Darkness lay thick as wax in the trees. We couldn't get Ariel to do anything but pace and rage and smoke. Sasha and Victor took off immediately. I thought, what's stopping me from leaving? Why can't I grab a taxi too? Do all the single people have to wait it out together? Vivian was a sex addict, undiagnosed, but Ariel was familiar with the signs. Vivian was illiterate. She was tits and ass, barely queer. Ariel was embarrassed to be seen with her. Vivian had used her. For what was unclear. Take the down pill, babe, I said. I smoked with her for solidarity, but I was sick, sweaty, shivering, coming down hard.
She's right, Ari. Where's the Xanax?
Ariel took two pills without stopping her tirade. She lit another cigarette before the first was finished. And just when I thought I was going to freeze to death on a bench in Union Square, her drugs kicked in. She stumbled. Will grabbed her and her head dropped down to her chest.
She took too much, he said.
Ariel slapped him and started laughing.
Like, too much, too much? Like, we're going to the hospital?
No, just difficult to handle too much.
He put her down on the bench, and we sat on either side of her. Her eyes were closed, her head cocked to the side. I put her hood on her, and Will and I looked at each other. I remembered how delicately he'd touched my face when we kissed, and felt repulsed, and then sad. Thank you for being nice to me, I said. He lit a cigarette and looked across the park, not taking the bait. Does this happen? I asked.
It has happened. It doesn't happen all the time. She has all these meds. It gets complicated.
I see that. You think Vivian is cheating?
No,
he said loudly into Ariel's ear. But then he met my eyes and shrugged. Sucks. We looked at her, looked at each other, then out at the park. I lifted my feet when I heard the rats. Neither of us wanted to deal with it. But I owed Will for getting me home safely more than once. We all owed Will, really. He never stopped watching over us. I'll take her. My place is closer to her place. She can walk in the morning.
Aren't you like fifth floor walk-up?
She's going to have to walk. I tapped her, and she didn't move. You're going to walk, Ari. Wind came through the park, and I could hear the trees bending, creaking. I haven't heard that in so long, I said, hushed, looking up. They're speaking like real trees. Ariel walked, but her eyes were closed. I guided her by our hooked arms. A cab materialized going south on Union Square West, a beacon of hope. The driver saw us and rolled down his window.
No puke, he said.
He had a drooping, ashen face, as if he'd been sleeping. I tried to open the doors, but they were locked. Come on, she's fine. He looked her up and down, and Ariel said, Fuck you! See, she's fine, I said. Please, I have cash. Extra tip. Por favor. Ariel took up the far two seats. As soon as we settled in, her head was on my shoulder. I held her hand and kissed it. The lit store windows turned Soho into a lunar landscape. nothing human for miles. I watched each block present itself to me, and I thought, who lives here? When we turned onto Delancey, Ariel's head fell onto my breast. When I picked her head up, she kissed me. She was so soft. Kissing her felt like trying to stand on a mossy stone in a river. Our lips ran over each other with no traction. Her hair drifted up as if we were underwater. After a minute, I became aware of it, and I started trying to kiss her back, performing, asking myself if I liked it. But for the first few seconds, all I knew was her mouth. I couldn't lose myself in it again. I let it go over the bridge. There was no groping, just the fine edges of teeth and a feathery tongue so yielding. I tilted my face down and told the driver to take the first exit. His eyes were locked on us in the rearview mirror. "You have beautiful lips," I said, pulling a few strands of her hair from my mouth. She didn't open her eyes. "Yes, yours are a shame, too." The driver took the turn too fast, and her head smashed into the window on the other side. She moaned the rest of the way. I was patient with her on the stairs. I couldn't make her brush her teeth. She was asleep before I finished brushing mine, taking up the entire bed. Her black hair splayed like spider legs on my pillow. Who lives here? 2. I heard the rain while I slept. Heard the cars moving like scissors shearing paper. It was my day off. I woke up out of breath, inflamed from the radiator. Someone was playing Edith Piaf out their window. It washed through the rain, the claustrophobic sky, and shot in my open window. It hit me in the chest, right where old Edith intended it to land. I couldn't imagine another life. They were both on today, their first shift back. He would be in at 3 p.m., although I imagined him coming in closer to 3:30. I couldn't find a rational reason to show up at work, but I felt calm for the first time in weeks, the wasted nights of their absence firmly behind me. I masturbated, thinking of him on top of me, suffocating me. And every time I got close to coming, he grabbed my face and said, "Pay attention." Then my own body felt like a bag filled with sand, and I fell back asleep. When I finally got out of bed, most of the shops were closing. The pavement was slick as I ran down Bedford and into the vintage shop. I bought the first one I tried on. The girl sized me up perfectly. It was mint condition, a black leather motorcycle jacket. When I saw myself in it, I thought, I want to be friends with her. I zipped it to my throat when a wind from the river shook rain from the branches. As I walked, I swear it, strangers looked at me differently. Who knew winter meant vegetables? Chef. No asparagus shipped in from Peru, no avocados from Mexico, no eggplants from Asia. What I assumed would be a season of root vegetables and onions was actually the season of chicories. Chef had his sources, which he guarded. Ska walked through the restaurant in the morning with unmarked brown paper bags, sometimes crates. He told me that the chicories would really brighten when the first freezes came. It sweetened their natural bitterness. I could barely keep track of them. The curly tangle of frisée didn't seem the same species as the heliotrope balls of radicchio or the whitened lobes of endive. Their familial trait was a bite, I thought of them as lettuces that bit back. Scott agreed. He said we should be hard on them. Eggs, anchovies, cream, a streak of citrus. Don't trust the French with your vegetables, Scott said. The Italians know how to let something breathe. I helped him wash frise, my hands stiff and frozen. The salad spinner was an appliance nearly my size, and Scott let me sit on top of it while it ricocheted around. I was nearly positive we had made out, but he seemed uninterested in reliving it. My pride was stunned, but I was relieved to have a friendship with a man. I knew he was dating a bartender in Williamsburg, had just broken something off with a hostess, and had his eye on the new Asian pastry girl. What's this one? The best one. He peeled off battered dark green outer leaves and gave me a leaf from the inside. I used it as a scoop for the tapenade. Escarole, he said. And those outside leaves? Soup. Just wait. Her distracted, concerned expression inspecting the server kit behind the bar. Those red lips. She seemed surprised to see me when I ran out to family meal. I hugged her. I wanted to say, I missed you. Instead, I said, hi. Hello, little one. Reserved, but a satisfaction somewhere. I felt it. She missed me, too. Did you hold down the fort while I was gone? Oh, Simone, it was awful. There were fruit flies, and Zoe didn't listen to me, and everyone got so drunk. Brown food, winter food, peasant food, she said, eyeing the soup. She only took one bowl. I knew he wasn't coming. I was watching her like she knew more than the schedule. A soup made with the bitter scraps and bits, where the sum is always greater than the parts. Yes, whatever you say, I said. White beans, escarole, chicken stock, skimmed until it was velvet, studded with sausage. I went back for seconds, then thirds. I became terrified of drains. I skipped my eyes over them in the dishwashing station. I wouldn't look down in my own bathroom. I didn't even want to see the pipes. I thought I would see a break in them, an air gap, where everything from the underworld would crawl up into the open air, where they would teem, thrive. It wasn't easy to catch Ariel outside work. She seemed to have an expansive network within the city that went beyond the restaurant, probably because she was an NYU kid who'd never left. I often asked her about college in the city. When I tried to imagine it, I thought, but wait, where do you move when school is over? When she said I could maybe, one day, come with her to a show, I didn't get my hopes up. When she said, do you want to come to a show this Thursday? I corralled my excitement. But I found myself in a closed-up office building on the west side, below 14th Street, and from the bleak, gray exterior, I was ready to be underwhelmed. Ariel and I doused in green and red light, making our way into a basement, where the drums tapped like a switch, echoes and duplicates colliding with the walls. A ragged-looking, middle-aged guy with gray hair paced the stage. He took lines of coke off a record that a little pixie held in the air like a serving platter. Whenever I heard electronic music, I thought of a man locked up in a room with computers, never of musicians. But I was watching it, with instruments, with a band that traded chemistry between themselves and the crowd. They released a song like a tidal wave. New York in the 70s, it was not. No disco decadence, drag queens, nudity, or androgyny. But even with this basement's lack of glamour, I was aware of being truly relevant within my time and of my time. Plain-faced kids with outsized glasses, girls in gritty fur vests and boots, deep, unmovable veins of apathy and inattention that made them care more about the next 10 minutes than the next 10 years. They, I guess it was we now, wanted dance music with a knife's edge. Ironic lyrics that crossed accidentally into sincere. Like they crossed into the sincere, accidentally, but every so often. Everyone was stripped down in the awkward peridot light, unself-conscious as they pogoed around. Ariel wore a tiny crop top under her sweater, highlighting her pale ribs. It read, "Disco for Assholes," and I wondered if I could wear something like that. She was confetti all over the room. People kept coming up to her, kissing her, and screaming. A waifish, anemic blonde girl kissed her on the lips, and Ariel bit her and hissed. She smiled at me, and I yelled, "That's not how you kissed me." "'Cause you're a baby, baby," she spun. "Amazing?" "Amazing," I yelled back. Self-deprecating, sentimental, sarcastic music, and I felt like I was breaking out of a corset. I was going to dance all night. The crowd diffused my sixth sense for Jake. He was there, next to me. He was the person Ariel jumped on, the person holding her hair off her neck while they spoke. This intimacy was surprising, but not as surprising as just him. Jake in the real world. He was supposed to be tethered to the restaurant where I imagined him when I wasn't at work. Ariel cupped her hands over her mouth and tunneled words into his ear. Jake had his eyes on me, and he nodded. I stopped dancing. She took his hand and pulled him away, but not before he gave me a tiny, condescending wave with his fingers. He was back. And I knew he wouldn't leave. Not like the other nights at the restaurant or park bar when I turned my back and he was vacuumed out by the night. No. Unplanned, unmediated, this was a regular Thursday night, with no shift at the restaurant behind or ahead of me. And Jake and I were at the same place. A cool place where cool people went. The pressure was lifting. I started dancing again, and I screamed for the band because I knew this song. It was my song, and I felt the source of the city's adrenalized, fatal energy. It was me. "You're really sweating," he said when I came up to the bar. "You're kind of a crazy dancer." "I am," I said flatly. I meant to say, coquettishly, "I am?" "You're into them?" he asked. He gestured toward the band. I nodded and shrugged, a subtle look that meant either A, they're so overrated, or B, they are like God. The look depended a lot on what Jake thought. "What are you doing here?" He gave me back that same amorphous shrug and nod, as if to say, "I go places." I wanted to ask, "What places?" "Did you work today?" "Banal." I couldn't think of anything else to say. A song started, and I turned toward the stage. "Let's go."
"What?"
"Let's go. Come on. If you keep dancing, you're going to hurt someone. Or yourself."
"Let's go?"
I held my hand to my ear. All I heard was that he had been watching me dance. "Ari's good. She met up with her people."
"Her people?"
I yelled. He shook his head at me like I was a fucking idiot, which I was. A deaf bobblehead trying to hear him. trying to see the tattoo on his collarbone. He had his glasses pushed up on top of his head, his hair suspended, a scientist pulled out of the laboratory. He grabbed me by the back of the neck and moved me toward the exit. It was pattering rain outside, translucent, needle rain, pricking my cheeks, collecting like quartz on my wrists where the light hit them. Our two exhalations coming in cold clouds. "Do you have an umbrella?" "I don't believe in them," he said. He walked over to his bike, chained against a tree. There was a plastic bag over the seat. "But you believe in protecting your bike seat?" Almost had him. Almost had a laugh. I didn't know it was a choice to believe in umbrellas. "All beliefs are a choice," he said. He rolled his bike, and I walked next to it. "That's really deep, Jake." I loaded it up with sarcasm. But what I thought was, "You're romantic." Raindrops perched on his eyebrows, on the lenses of his glasses, on his ears. I was suddenly very sober and scared. "Are we going to Park Bar?" "Is that the only bar you've been to?" "No." "Yes, more or less." "I'm taking you to dinner." He's taking me to dinner. I watched my feet until my laughter made it impossible, and I covered my mouth. "I am," he said. "Why are you laughing?" "You're taking me to dinner?" "Are you a fucking parrot? Stop repeating everything I say." But he couldn't finish it. He laughed. "Jake, I would love to go to dinner with you." Heads down, frizzy rain, rocking with laughter. It wasn't funny, but it took some time to stop appearing that way. When it ended, we looked away from each other, and I stared into ground floor apartments. I bumped into the bike. I wondered if we were going to the restaurant. All the servers got vouchers, monthly allowances that you could spend or accrue. I would get one too after I'd been there 6 months. It was such an incongruity to see her coworkers sit at the bar. They treated themselves like royalty with their fake money, ordering everything on the menu, rubbing elbows with the regulars, sharing their bottles of burgundy. It scared me to think about watching from the other side, watching the bar tickets drag, knowing that Chef was screaming at someone about my entree, watching Howard or, God forbid, Simone, going over my order with the server while I was drinking or talking with my mouth full. But what if Jake opened the door for me? What if the hostess's eyes flashed when she saw him and then settled on me? Her disappointment would be so satisfying. I would let Jake order. I watched the oyster plate drop down in front of us, Nikki bringing out two Negronis. Then that anchovy and escarole salad everyone talked about. Chef would probably send out the foie gras torchon with candied kumquats. Simone would want us to drink Sauterne with that. She always dropped off half glasses to her soigne tables. Every time I rose from my seat, a back waiter would come and refold and fan my napkin. And Jake would look marvelously unkempt without his stripes, like a wealthy degenerate, and I would be... "I have a thing about shitty diners," he said. He stopped in front of the plate glass windows and gaudy lights of a diner somewhere on 6th Avenue. He pulled open a door and said, "I love them." A half moon, radiating yellow, revolved above us. But the sign had so much sparkling plumage, I couldn't read the name of the place. There were a few others inside, a nondescript trench coat at the bar, an older couple in a booth. Jake took me to the counter, to the corner, and jumped on the stool while I tried to flatten my hair. He pulled off his soaked green army jacket, and his shirt sleeves were short enough that I could see tattoos. There was the key on the inside of his biceps, which I saw now was heavily scarred. The bottom of a buffalo that I assumed covered his shoulder. The tail of fins of what I assumed was a mermaid descending down the back of his right biceps. "That one doesn't look like the others," I said, pointing to the key. "Yeah, it fell out partially." He pulled down his shirt sleeve. "The key to your heart?" I asked playfully, stupidly. "Sure, princess," he said. He scanned the menu, and I shut up. To our right sat a couple not much older than me. She had long, ironed platinum hair with sooty roots. She wore a fake flower crown. The guy was so hairy I couldn't make out his face. Bearded, long hair sticking out from under a woolen cap, wearing red and black flannel. They looked familiar to me, probably from my neighborhood. "I think they were at the show," I said. Jake looked visibly pained.
"They're everywhere,"
says the guy with American Spirit cigarettes and the bike. A terse smile. "Did someone learn what a hipster is? Very good, new girl." What I knew was that they lived in Williamsburg and the label was pejorative. And I knew that I would never be one. Even in my leather jacket, I couldn't blend in. I cared too much about the wrong things. The waitress behind the counter threw two giant menus at us and walked away. "No specials?" Jake studied the menu. When she came back, he ordered us both black coffees and Coors Lights. "Steak and eggs," he said. He waited for me. I hadn't even looked. "What's good?" I asked her. "Nothing," she said and smiled. She was firmly into her 50s, pillowy, and had drawn Egyptian cat eyes with black eyeliner through her wrinkles. "A turkey club, I guess," I said. "Is that a good choice?" She took our menus. Jake didn't look at me, like he thought he had made a mistake. I told myself to just be normal. Casual. Two friends at a diner. Totally cool. She was enthusiastic. "How was home?" I asked, not meeting his eyes. "Home? For Thanksgiving?" "Fucking brutal, per usual. There's a reason there's so many suicides out there during the winter."
"But you got to see your family?"
"I don't have any family. I go to Simone's." I had a dozen questions to ask. What does that mean? What happened to your family? What is Simone's family? Why didn't you stay here? I finally said, "I don't have any family either." Should I believe that? A little Jane Eyre alone in the world? "I thought you didn't flirt with girls who read." He coughed and said, "I'm not." A month ago, I had seen Jake eat a steak topped with foie gras. The cooks made fun of him behind his back because he was thin, and made him disgustingly decadent food as a dare. He ate nonstop while he worked. But I held a certain regard for his palate because of Simone. Then I watched him wolf down a cindery steak and eggs at midnight, and I realized he was a brute who was always hungry. He was the master of indifference, and she was the master of attention. "So," I said, grinding the cardboard sandwich down into the plate.
"When did you move here?"
7, 8 years ago? I don't know. I can't remember.
"And you've been at the restaurant the whole time?"
"About 5 years too long."
"You don't like it?"
"These places have a shelf life."
"But no one leaves."
He shook his head rather sadly. "No one leaves." He pushed my coffee toward me and I sipped. Weak, watery. Cinnamon, am I right, Nancy? He said to the waitress. She ignored him. They put cinnamon in the blend. I don't think her name is Nancy. I pushed the coffee away. A snob already. That was quick. No. I picked the white bread out of the sandwich, dipped it in the mayonnaise, and crumbled up bacon with my fingers. Inedible, but I probably couldn't have touched it anyway. So many times I imagined this, and now that I was living it, I couldn't fit myself into the scene. I glanced at Flower Crown and Lumberjack as they got ready to leave. I tried to see us through her eyes. I tried to see us as a couple that always ate at these stools. Us inside an Edward Hopper painting. So, I said. His eyes were on his rapidly disappearing food. What neighborhood do you live in? Do you like it? Are you interviewing me? I wasn't trying. No, it's fine. I get it. Just let me put on my suit if you want to play. He tucked his hair behind his ears and cleared his throat. The time in my life that best exemplifies my hospitalitarian attitude was when I carried Trunk Gold Neely. Okay, I get it. You don't want to tell me where you live. He went back to his food. You carried Mrs. Neely? Many a time. Many a time. She's as light as a feather. He cleaned his plate completely, pushed it away. He burped and turned to me. Finally. Chinatown. That's cool. I hear it's really cool down there. Cool? I don't know. Is that not the right word? Is that like what a hipster would say? No, cool is fine, he said. Yes, it's a cool place. It was much cooler 7 years ago. And it was actually cool 10 years ago, before I even got to the city. You see, what those kids over there, he pointed at the empty booth, don't realize is that cool is always past tense. The people who lived it, who set the standards they emulate, there was no cool for them. There was just the present tense. There were bills, friendships, messy fucking boredom, a million trite decisions on how to pass the time. Self-awareness destroys it. You call something cool and you brand it, then poof, it's gone. It's just nostalgia. I see, I said, though I don't know that I did. Those two, to go back to our apt illustrations, they want to play dropouts, want to live la vie bohème. They want to eat at blue-collar diners, ride their bikes like fucking apes, tear their clothes, discourse on anarchy. And they want to shop at J. Crew. They want dinner parties with organic artisanal chickens, and they want their fucking Southeast Asia sojourns and their jobs at American Express. They come here, but they can't finish their plates. I took another leaden bite. You can't have all those things? Sweetheart, you can't make a set of aesthetic decisions without making an ethical one. That's what makes them fake people. I forced my sandwich down. Don't worry, you're not like them. I know. It sounded defensive. None of us are. Even if you grew up in a country club, which I can tell you did, you're in the struggle now. That's authentic. And whatever your story is, I don't see mommy and daddy all over you. You think I grew up in a country club? I know you did. He drained me. You don't know me. Maybe I don't. And you don't know me. And none of us know anything about each other. Well, I don't think that's useful. Sometimes people, I don't know, go out to dinner or get coffee or whatever the fuck, and get to know each other. And then what happens? They live happily ever after? I don't know, Jake. I'm trying to find out. My head hurt. I propped it on my arm and took a big drink of flat beer. Don't get drunk. Excuse me? You're sloppy when you drink. Enough. I opened my throat and chugged my awful beer all the way down. It leaked out of the corners of my mouth and ran down my neck. When I finished, I said, "Fuck you and good night."
"Hey, firecracker, give me a second."
A normal man, in this rough pantomime of a date, would put his hand on my hand and apologize. He would reveal just enough vulnerability to convince me to stay and keep digging. Jake of Chinatown, Jake of greasy diners, Jake of exuberant hair in an umbrella-less city. He put his hand under my shirt, right on my ribs, and pushed me onto the stool. He took his hand off me. His fingers had been freezing, but I felt branded. "You're incandescent when you drink." "That too." I exhaled. A consolation. "It's the truth. You can take it. It's something." I had my purse in my lap, but when the waitress came back, I ordered another beer. My ribs, my life, my train. "You read too much Henry Miller," I said to him. "That's why you think you can treat girls like this." "You're a decade off, but yeah, I used to read too much Henry Miller."
"Who do you read too much of now?"
"I don't read anymore."
"Seriously?"
"You could call it a crisis of faith. I haven't read a book or even a newspaper in 2 years.
"Is that why you quit your doctorate?"
"Who told you that?"
"I don't know. Simone?"
"Simone did not tell you that."
"Yeah, she did."
She hadn't. But I could tell by his sudden attention that it was true. "But then you're the Anais Nin type, right?"
"Not really."
"I was, or had been, or always would be." "We're both a couple of imperfect types." He smiled, and it was soft. "You missed me," I said, not quite believing it as I said it, but knowing it. "You want me to tell you that I missed you?" "No, I want you to be nice to me, actually." "I'm mean because you're young and need discipline."
"I'm sick of that," I said. "Young, young, young, that's what I get all day, every day, but I know your secret."
I lowered my voice and pushed myself toward him.
"You're all terrified of young people.
We remind you of what it was like to have ideals, faith, freedom. We remind you of the losses you've taken as you've grown cynical, numb, disenchanted, compromising the life you imagined. I don't have to compromise yet. I don't have to do a single thing I don't want to do. That's why you hate me." He looked at me, and I knew he was thinking about disciplining me. "Do people tend to underestimate you?"
"I have no idea. I'm too busy trying not to fuck up."
He was still looking at me, my shoulders, my breasts, into my lap. To be turned over by his eyes was like being paralyzed. "You know," he said and leaned forward. Our knees touched. I could see his pores, the tiny blackheads around his nose, and I remembered his up-close face. "I get the sense that you are extremely powerful. I felt it when we kissed. I felt it when you were speaking just then. Like I had tapped into an electrical current. But then I watch you and you spend most of your sober hours holding it back. Maybe you don't have to compromise yet, but you're going to have to choose between your mind and your looks. If you don't, The choices will become narrower and narrower until they are hardly even choices, and you'll have to take what you can get. At some point, you decided it was safer to be pretty. You sit on men's laps and listen to their idiotic jokes and giggle. You let them give you back rubs. Let them buy your drugs and your drinks. Let them make you special meals in the kitchen. Don't you see when you do that, all the while you're... He reached out and wrapped his hand around my throat. I stopped breathing. Choking. I held my head as still as a vase. Something breakable that had a crack. And the crack was spreading. I said, I felt it too, when we... His phone rang. It was the most intrusive sound I could imagine. Even Jake looked annoyed. But he looked at the number and jumped off his stool and walked to the bathroom, and I continued to hold perfectly still. The waitress came to clear the plates. She stacked them in the most disordered, haphazard stack I'd ever seen. Even I could do better. She threw them roughly in the bus tub. The plates landed with a crack, and the silverware slipped with a slight splash into the juices that lived in the bottom of the bus tubs. I had pitied her when we came in, but now I realized that we had the same job. Debbie, he called out to the waitress. Nancy? Sandra? He didn't sit back down on the stool. He was leaning against the counter now, and I knew our night was over. I have to go, he said. I was supposed to meet someone 20 minutes ago. I nodded, perfunctorily. But I heard this. It wasn't some undeclared rule that kept him from taking me home all those nights I was practically begging for it. He was interested. It was that I wasn't living up to my potential. This is my treat, a belated holiday dinner. I heard you had a wild Thanksgiving. Sorry I missed it. He pulled cash out of his wallet. He sent off a text while he drank his beer. I spun around on my stool, watched people duck into doorways out of the fluorescent rain. I'm different, I said, not caring about how simple-minded I sounded. I knew how he saw me, grasping, lost. I didn't know yet in which ways he was right or wrong. But what he didn't know was that I had escaped. That I had gotten myself here. I helped myself to his beer. I don't have to choose between my looks or whatever. I'm going to have everything. Didn't you say that the aesthetic and the ethical must coexist? I hit him with my knees. Now, where the fuck am I and how do I get home? 3. Did you know fish have a 4-second memory? Terry asked me. I was pretending to read an Old New Yorker in the candlelight, my eyes scanning the same lines of a poem over and over again. What will unleash itself in you when your storm comes? But really thinking about the Coke in my purse, how there was a nice weight to it there, with an entire evening ahead. I thought briefly about leaving before everyone got there. But the night was muddy, and I couldn't see past it, or through it, or even to the next 5 minutes. The bar was empty, so it meant that Terry was talking to me. Huh? I always think of that when you guys come in here after your shift. Get it? Yeah, Terry, I get it. We are the fish, and this is the fucking water. This one had been Mrs. Neely's mother's. It was a wine-purple velvet cloche with gold embroidery that was nearly worn away. It hugged her tiny skull and lifted slightly so she could bat her eyes at me. Her mother, she told us, had been a legendary beauty. She attended all the art salons, held her own in conversation with W.E.B. Du Bois and Langston Hughes. Quite progressive. She didn't have time to make art, supporting her children as a seamstress after her husband died, but she had an artistic flair for living. I don't understand it now, she said, taking both my hands in hers emphatically. You didn't leave the house without a hat. We were not fancy people. My mother made dresses out of curtains. But I would have been indecent without my hats. My mama would have slapped a girl like you silly the way you dress. I know, I said. I encouraged her to admonish me, and she loved to dole it out. Girls now, they wear leggings, as pants. It's embarrassing. Just parading their coochies around town. Jesus, but yes, they actually do that. Where are the standards? How is a man gonna know what to do with you? She slapped the back of my hand. You dressing like a boy, hiding your figure. You still hitting them on the playground so they'll look at you. I nodded, totally unmasked. You know, style isn't frivolous. In my day, it was a sign of your integrity, a sign that you knew who you were. I nodded, but she was looking beyond me. Oh, there's my prince. Sasha sauntered toward us like he was on a runway. Mrs. Neely applauded, her eyes watering. Neely, darling, you are out of vision. Now why are you talking to this trash? Give me a kiss, for goodness sake. She offered up her cheek shyly, and he kissed her on both sides. That's how they used to do it in Paris, she said. How's the lamb, my love? Terrible. It was absolutely terrible. She looked troubled and gestured for us to come closer. I swear, every time, worse and worse. Marvelous, said Sasha, shining his teeth on her. Sasha, will you take this beautiful young lady out on a date? She needs a real gentleman in her life. Yes, Sasha, I turned to him. A few weeks ago, he dropped his pizza on the ground and offered me $50 to eat it. I did, and he paid me, like a gentleman. When are you going to take me out? We were both shaking with restrained laughter. Mrs. Neely laughed too, settled into her chair, regal. I knew he was down there. He had just told Nikki he was going down to find a bottle of scotch, even though I had told him, for over a week, that we were out. I'd even asked Howard about it, and he'd told me it was backordered at the distributor. And yet Jake refused to believe it. I wondered if he was looking because he didn't trust my information, or because he wanted to draw out this small duel between us. So when Simone asked if someone could pull the Opus 2002 from the cellar for her, she had just been double-sat. I said absolutely, tightened my ponytail, and ran. He didn't turn when I came in. It's not here, I said, walking purposefully to the California Red section. Those who would believe the words of women would be fools. Charming. I scanned the wall, but I already knew where the Opus was. I wished that I knew nothing, that I was wrong about the scotch, that we were out of Opus, and we had to spend the rest of service in the cellar looking for bottles that didn't exist. He grunted. I pulled the wine and went to peer over his shoulder at the mess of stray bottles I had already been through 1,000 times. Hey, I said, you're bleeding. He had a cut on his forearm. He looked down, confused, and I reached out instinctively and brought his forearm to my mouth and licked the cut. My tongue metallic, salty, a spark. When I realized what I had done, I pushed his arm back to him. I exhaled and he inhaled. His nostrils flared. My eyes said, I dare you. I felt tears. I felt bottomless. I felt liquid. Excuse me, she said, Simone stood in the doorway. I blinked at her, wondering what I was seeing.
The opus?
I looked at my hand and walked the bottle over to her. I waited for some sarcastic comment.
Well, I would have just done it myself, is what Heather would say.
Ariel would say, what the fuck, Skip, you fucking cunt? Either of those would have been acceptable. Simone said nothing but looked at us. She was silent, and I knew I'd fucked up.
You want a peach treat?
I looked at Heather dumbly. I had properly fucked up, so when the rest of the night took a turn toward chaos, I knew it was my fault. Tables ran over their turn times. They sat sipping water contentedly while the waiting parties tapped their feet and impatience, anxiety, frustration gathered in a prickly cloud. The most desired tables were refused. They were too close to the hutch, too close to the bathroom, too small, too isolated, too noisy. Servers were mishearing orders. They stood nervously outside the kitchen, avoiding telling chef for as long as possible, making up circuitous stories of how it wasn't their fault. Chef slammed food into the trash dramatically until Howard stopped him and started gifting the mistakes around the room.
That opus?
I wanted to blame him, but couldn't. Somehow, I pulled the 1995, not the 2002. Somehow, Simone presented it, opened it, and tasted them on it. Somehow, Howard spotted it while making the rounds in the dining room. He said,
Ah, the 95. What an incredible bottle. How is it drinking this evening?
The robust man at the table laughed darkly.
Better than the 2002 I ordered. Thanks for that.
Did you hear?
Ariel asked, swinging past me with plates. She came back a moment later with empty hands and said, Simone fucked up for real. I saw Howard and her in the hutch, his voice calm with none of his usual inquisitiveness, just sharp.
Highly allocated, massive loss. Not like you.
No, I wanted to say, it wasn't like her. It was like me. But I watched Simone nodding, her lipstick worn through in the center of her lips where she was biting them. I felt sick. Heather came to pick up coffee, and I confessed.
Happens, she said, waving me off. But Simone, it's her fault. She presented it. She said the vintage out loud. She pointed to it. She should have noticed. That's why she's a server. And you're a back waiter.
I was unconvinced.
You want a peach treat?
What's that?
Just a Xanax.
She pulled out a peach-colored pill.
You think I can do my job on that?
Pumpkin, a monkey could do your job on Xanax.
And probably not fuck up as much. It's not a real drug.
Or a real job, I thought as I took it. Simone came up to the service bar.
My cappuccino's on 43.
Already went, I said eagerly. I delivered them myself less than 5 minutes after she put the order in, putting it ahead of the other 5 tickets. She turned to Heather.
Do you have another?
She popped the pill in her mouth and swallowed without water. Simone, I said, I'm sorry.
Don't. She said cordially.
Heather, 86 the 95 opus. That was the last bottle.
The pill was lodged in my throat. I kept swallowing, but it dissolved there, and it tasted like Jake's sour blood. He didn't speak to me for the rest of the night. The espresso machine had always been a hot zone for us. The beverage runners were to clean it extra diligently. And I assumed the other back waiters did. But after a cockroach crawled out of a portafilter I had just picked up, after I threw the whole thing at the wall, spraying coffee grinds everywhere, leaving a dent. After the bug walked away unharmed, well, I stopped taking my cleaning of the espresso machine so seriously. Zoe was supposed to be our general in this war.